yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yes, sing it hard, and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found, whose crimes have gone unpunished now. Walk the streets a screaming now. They brought death to our hometown. Greetings, all you 99 percenters. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions, where we talk about solutions to the political and economic crisis in America, increasingly growing here. And today, as I had announced last week, we have a special session here. And we're going to talk about the AFL-CIO, the labor movement, and relationship to community groups, and what appears to be, or not to be, a deepening alliance between labor and community groups. I'm talking about groups like the NAACP, La Raza, Sierra Club, and others. Talked before the recent AFL-CIO convention that just occurred here last week of perhaps a deepening relationship and partnership between organized labor, union labor, and community organizations. But a lot of questions up in the air. Would these groups be affiliates? Would they be full members with voting rights and AFL-CIO decisions? Would they pay dues? Would this just be at the top? Or would this be all the way down the hierarchy and the structure of union labor in this country? Just a little bit of background before I introduce my guests. Labor is in a big crisis. Union labor and labor in general. We talked about the fact that last year, union labor, union members declined by 500,000. Now that is really significant, not simply because of the absolute number of the decline in membership, but the fact that it's 4 years after the so-called end of the recession. Labor is still gushing members. 500,000 when last year over a 1.5 million jobs were created in 2012. Even so, 500,000 union members disappeared in the private sector. Organized labor is down to 6.6% of the labor force unionized. That's less than it was in 1929, after a decade of attacks on labor in that earlier period. I think it was like 7 or 8% on the eve of the Great Depression. So it's the worst we've seen since sometime probably in the 1870s in terms of union membership and organization. There were 22% of the workforce that was still organized in 1980. Today, it's down to about 11%. If labor still had the 22% that it had in 1980, we'd have about 35 million members in the AFL-CIO instead of the current 16. Okay, and it's not just union membership. It's union efforts at organizing new workers is at an all-time low. We've got two-tier wage and benefit contracts now for the last couple decades that have been creating, sort of lower level of citizenry in the workforce here, getting half wages and no benefits. They call that two-tier. We've got declining income. Median family income, that's working class income. Right? People are making $40,000-$50,000 a year. That's declined 10% since 2000 and has been falling about 1-1.5% per year during this so-called recovery. And recovery means going backwards for workers in this country, even though the rich, as a recent report showed, since 2009, the 1% got 95% of all the income gains over the last 4 years. 95% went to the 1%. Can you believe that? Okay, you know, that's not some radical estimate. That comes from Professor Emmanuel Saez at the University of California, Berkeley, who's been looking at IRS data for 10 years now, and it's getting worse. In the 1990s, the wealthiest 1% got 45% of all the income gains. During George Bush, they got 65%. Now, under Barack Obama, they get 95%. Okay, so in terms of income, the working class in this country is going backwards, pedaling backwards at a rapid rate. Jobs in manufacturing, you know, they talk about, oh, manufacturing recovery. Don't believe it. We had 18 million workers in manufacturing in 2000. We got a little over 11 million today. 7 million we've lost out of a workforce of 155 million. Construction, only half of the workers we had in 2007 have jobs in construction. Not only at the production level, but the political strategy of organized labor is clearly failed. What we've got now is very clearly at the federal level, labor can't get anything out of the Democratic Party anymore. You know, the organizing legislation to stop employers from beating up on folks because they want to have a union, EFCA it was called, never even got out of committee under the Democrats. And they had a majority in both houses of Congress in the first term, at least the first 2 years, 2 years of Obama's first term. And we see retreats politically at the state level. Right-to-work laws, Wisconsin, Michigan. We've lost 700,000 public workers under this crisis. Labor's bargaining strategy is now clearly a failure. In the last 15 years, that strategy has been characterized by what's called maintenance of benefits. In other words, union workers have agreed to give up wage increases in order to maintain their level of benefits, their pensions, and their health care, employer-negotiated pensions and health care. And now we see, at a political level, the collapse of employer union-negotiated health care plans is coming. It's already beginning. And, of course, we know we've already had a collapse in pensions as employers have shedded defined benefit pension plans and replaced them with 401k plans. Obama's Affordable Care Act is an inheritor, consequence of Bush's health savings accounts. It's privatization. That's what it is, and it would mean the end of the destruction of union-negotiated health care plans, which they call Cadillac plans. So what we've got is a failure of a negotiating strategy, fundamental strategy, a decline, massive decline in membership, a decline in wages, a decline in income, and a failure at the political level. This led President of the AFL-CIO, Richard Trumka, just before the convention to say, quote, "The crisis for labor has deepened. We're at the point where we really must do something differently. We really have to experiment," unquote. Okay. With that quote and that information, enter the recent AFL-CIO convention, and I want my two guests to first give me their take on what happened at the recent convention in general, but in particular in relationship to the so-called talk of a new alliance with community organizations as an attempt to revitalize the union movement, the organized union movement in this country. Who do I have? I've got two very special guests who are both delegates, by the way, to the convention. So this is an eyewitness report from these two fellows. One is Steve Early, a longtime staff representative for the Communication Workers of America, and you know, with a biography that's just too long and impressive to mention all the details here. But you know, Steve has been in down there in the grassroots of organized labor for decades, so he can provide a view of this convention that very few can, and no less impressive in terms of his union credentials is my second guest, Carl Fenimore, who was a local president for the International Association of Machinists, the airline workers division, for many, many years. Welcome both of you, Carl and Steve.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks,
okay.
Jeff.
Here's a question. Here's a question for you. What happened at the convention? What was the decision here in terms of labor community alliances, and what's your assessment of that? Steve, why don't you take that one?
Well, there were many progressive, pleasingly progressive resolutions passed by the AFL convention delegates last week in Los Angeles. One of them, Resolution 5, as you indicated, Jack, reaffirmed organized labor's support for becoming a broader, more inclusive and effective labor movement. This particular measure really is kind of a celebration of the good work that some unions have been doing with workers' centers, which are labor advocacy groups that represent workers who have not yet won collective bargaining rights, don't operate within formal union structures, but have been able to make some gains in particular sectors of the economy, primarily on behalf of immigrant workers. The resolution about broader labor community coalition building also pushes the idea of expanding and deepening labor ties, which already exist with student groups and with people of faith, with low-income organizations, with any kind of working-class organization that shares common goals with organized working people in unions. So I think all of that was very positive. Some efforts in this area have actually been underway for more than 25 years, perhaps the best example being the Jobs with Justice Community Labor Coalition network around the country. Jobs with Justice has been a very strong ally of union organizing and bargaining and lobbying for labor law reform. Hopefully that is one of a number of relationships that will get greater encouragement and hopefully also financial backing from the AFL-CIO as a result of the debates and discussion and resolution passing at this meeting last week.
Carl, what's your take?
Yeah, well first, Steve and I are actually retired, so we weren't delegates. We had press credentials, which meant roam around all over, and both of us were also at the convention 4 years ago, and the report I wrote at that time 4 years ago indicated, you know, there were 1,000 delegates and 2,000 guests, and actually with all the hoopla and the stage production at this convention, it actually was smaller. There was not 1,000 delegates, but there were around 700, and there certainly weren't 2,000 guests. Or far less than that. So that just reflects the decline that you pointed out, Jack, about labor. And despite all the hoopla and trying to really drum up support for this new campaign to reach out and draw more people into the labor movement, actually, in my opinion, it derived from a deep pessimism that you could not, as Steve just wrote in one of his articles for Labor Notes recently, they are afraid to challenge the employers at the work site. They are afraid to mobilize and educate their own members to take on the employers. Because to take on the employers, you really can't do it without taking on the government, the Department of Labor, National Labor Relations, Occupational Safety, every department of the government. They don't want to do that because they're in a partnership with the Democratic Party and Obama, which is endured since the Roosevelt coalition of the 1930s, and it's produced nothing but catastrophe for labor. On three important subjects that came up at the convention highlight this problem. One was the minimum wage. They passed a resolution that supported the Democratic Party's federal legislation for a little over $10 an hour. That's peanuts. That'll still be poverty. $10 an hour. The fast food workers, as Steve points out, the worker centers who are doing great job, they're calling for $15 an hour. Fight for 15. The labor movement is stuck in this partnership and places the partnership with the Democratic Party in their lousy $10, $10.65 an hour minimum wage over the needs, the real needs of families whose income has declined. Secondly, they refuse to really criticize in their written resolutions the Affordable Care Act, which goes into effect in 2014 with incredible taxes against union health care plans that have protected workers for decades.
40%. 40% by 2018, right? There's an excise tax. They're going to tax. I mean, that's going to destroy union employer negotiated plans. And I don't think the employers are going to wait to 2018 to do that. As we've seen, their whole strategy now is put a cap on everything between now and then. So it's the ACA, the Obamacare, is the beginning and the end of the union plans. And we even saw unions trying to last week get Obama to allow their low-paid members, like in restaurants, multi-employer plans, to be able to get some of the subsidies that are going to be available from the government as part of the ACA. And Obama pretty much told them, go take a hike. You're not going to get, we're not going to give you any, you can't participate even though you are low-paid in this. So the writing's on the wall in terms of union-negotiated health care plans, just as they've destroyed defined benefit plans with privatization and 401ks. This is the analog for 401ks, and we're going to see the end of it. And as I said, you know, if maintenance of benefits strategy negotiations, put your money in benefits instead of wages, is now gone, if it's the beginning of the end of that, and labor can't get wage increases, what the hell is it all about?
Exactly.
Okay, that's my piece. Go ahead. Sorry, but I had to get that off my chest.
Right.
You know, and if the current form, one more comment, the current form of organization, the AFL-CIO, has produced this failure in political strategy, failure in production, point of production strategy. If this organization structure is part of this, well, then how are you going to change this? What are you going to do? You know, if you look at the history of labor, whenever labor has been revitalized, it has changed its strategy and its organization. We saw the destruction of the Knights of Labor back in the 19th century. We had a new organization and strategy come out of the AFL. We saw the crisis during the Depression in the 1930s. We had a new organization structure and strategies that come out of that in the CIO. Okay, so now globalization and all these other things have destroyed the CIO, pretty much. What's the new strategy? Labor must not only restructure its self-organization, I believe it must fundamentally reinvent itself as it has done so for centuries, time and time again, and come back. Has any progress towards that occurred with this decision at the AFL-CIO convention? Is this partnership just same-o, more of the same, with a lot of talk about new alliances, but nothing really new? I mean, from what Steve read to me of the resolution, you know, jobs for justice, so on and so forth, FACE, student group, that doesn't sound to me any different than what's existed up to now. Steve, what do you think of that? Is it any different?
No, I think it's a repackaging, recycling of good ideas that reformers in AFL-CIO headquarters have been pushing since the mid-1990s when John Sweeney was elected president of the Federation in the first contested election it had held in 100 years, and you had a new voice slate, including the current president, Rich Trumka, come into office nearly 20 years ago, promoting many of the same good ideas. That the problem is the disconnect between, people who are often good, sincere trade unionists functioning at the top of the labor bureaucracy and rank-and-file union members struggling with the problems that Carl just mentioned, in the workplace. And, you know, one of the ironies of this convention was that one of the best examples of bottom-up, grassroots revitalization of a major union, which was what's happened in the Chicago Teachers Union over the last few years, was really not showcased or highlighted at the convention at all. The CTU, the Chicago Teachers, who waged a major strike last year, have won plaudits throughout the country for the way that they have educated and reinvigorated and mobilized their members and enlisted community allies to fight the corporate-backed school reform schemes of Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel. This model local was allotted one presenter at a side meeting, one among 50 workshops. And there was clearly a lot of concern by the national union that the CTU is affiliated with, the American Federation of Teachers, that this model might spread, because this model involves rank and file members forming a reform caucus within their local union, running better people for office who are committed to rank and file empowerment and a different strategy for labor and for their own union, and challenging the direction of both their local and their national union. So I think it was quite telling that the people who had led the second largest strike in the country in the last several years now lead a major revitalized and reform-minded big city teachers union were just a kind of a footnote to this convention, when in fact we should all be looking at what teachers did in Chicago to rebuild their union as a model for other teachers and union members throughout the country.
What was the change, if any, in terms of the Chicago teachers' alliances with the community? Was there something significant there that,
the Chicago strike
was the only one that I've seen in years that has been successful.
Yeah, and it wasn't successful because they passed correctly worded resolutions or tried to cozy up to politicians. I mean, they reached out to the community in Chicago that has a stake in the survival of decent public education. They enlisted students and parents and low-income organizations and church congregations to become supporters of their contract campaign. They've been fighting public school closings that adversely affect the public that the teachers serve in Chicago. They understood that as workers in the public sector making better wages and benefits than many of the people in the community they served, it would have been very easy for the school board and Mayor Emanuel to scapegoat them as a special interest group, as selfish and greedy people who union members who deserve to be forced to make give backs because they're so much better off supposedly than the rest of the community. Well, the reformers in the Chicago Teachers Union built such strong ties with the community they serve that message failed, and they were able to build public support for their strike and fend off the worst of the contract concessions that Mayor Emanuel was seeking. And I think that, again, is a lesson for both public employees and even private sector workers. You do need allies, but you can't use allies effectively if you don't have a mobilized and well-organized union membership.
Carl, moving to you here. There was talk before the convention, Trumka even let it slip or threw it out, either one, in some interviews before the convention, that the FLCO was thinking of having these community groups directly affiliate. And I think, if I recall the quote right from the New York Times, that Trumka even said, and that would include sharing decision-making power. Right? Votes, in other words, at the AFL-CIO Federation level. Did that come out of this resolution, or was that stripped from the resolution at the convention?
No, they put on the International Executive Board a very articulate and very dedicated young woman of color on the International Executive Board. But taxicab drivers are not organized. I mean, they broke the union a long time ago. And she's valiantly trying to get it back. So they've already added someone to their own executive board, international executive board.
I mean, from a community group, though. I mean, like La Raza or NAACP or something. That's what Trumka was talking about before.
Yeah, maybe Steve knows more, but I think those details, Trumka said, are still going to be worked out. But, you know, the real essence of it is what Steve's been talking and writing about, and what I'm very concerned about is reaching out to community groups is something we've been advocating and advising for 20 years. It's good. It's positive. But you will know that there'll be some changes when the labor movement starts calling conventions of its own workers, like the Chicago teachers did. They had thousands of their own members assembled before the strike, months and years before the strike, with community groups where they did an intense education job that is absolutely essential before the mobilization occurs, before the strikes occurred. So the Chicago teachers, and I can tell you, having attended the nurses conventions, the unionized nurses, they do an intense education on what the employers are doing, and they involve the community group on that basis. It's not just to talk about what's going on in the job, but it's what health care, how education affects the whole population. It's just not dollars and cents trying to fight for a higher wage. It's taking up and integrating the social consequences of what the employers are doing to workers and workers' families. And so the unity that was talked about here, or reaching out in the partnership and all the alliances with the community, is hollow. It will not work unless you see the AFL-CIO, the building trades, the machinists union, and others taking up the example of the nurses and of the Chicago teachers. But that wasn't mentioned, and that is not going to happen. Because in Chicago, they had to take on the Democratic Party machine that was closing these schools. And they took it on in the way I said, educate. You see, I know, and anyone that's in the union movement knows, there's been a dumbing down, a depoliticization of the local units of most unions. You know, the hotel workers are different. I named a couple others that are different. There are exceptions. But for the most part, only 2% of union members for the last 20 years even attend meetings, number one. Number two, except during contract times, you can't talk to a worker about what's going on. They don't know. They're not informed. They're not educated. They don't understand about the social issues that affect them. They're the immigration, broader health care, single payer. There's not the proper education, which is essential to mobilization. But that's because this, and I'll end on this, the AFL-CIO leadership and the conservative leadership of most unions is not interested in mobilizing its own membership in partnership with the community to win gains, social gains and economic gains. It's more interested in working with the political power structure to give it some concessions, to give it some edge. But we know how well that's working for us.
Well, let me again play the devil's advocate here. You know, the question is, even if labor, organized labor, was doing more than it is doing in terms of mobilizing its own members, you still only have in the AFL-CIO, what, 11, 12 million out of 155 million in the labor force? It seems to me that the big problem is with that small membership, fragmented and in retreat all over the place, how can it come back without some kind of alliance with other progressive forces in the community? Now, that seems to be the key strategic question. Can it do that without some sort of alliance? And, you know, face it, labor talks about a lot about partnership with communities. They talk a good talk. But I don't see organized labor and unions out there with their signs and mobilizing their members to help the community in terms of stopping foreclosures. You know, Steve might say something about that, because he lives in the city where something's going on, and helping the unemployed. I don't see organized unions, apart from talking the talk, actually doing much. So unless you have a structured, a kind of a new structure where both community groups and union groups belong to the same organization, have the same stake, and that organization is fighting, you know, first on the community front, then on a labor front, a union front, a strike, a boycott, foreclosures, helping students, and so on and so forth. Unless you have that organization, it's just not going to happen. And I'm not very optimistic about organization at the AFL-CIO Federation level. Big deal. What I see, and I think there's an inkling of this message in Chicago, is there's got to be organization integration at the grassroots level, because, you know, you can call on the community to help you and so forth, but unless they have a stake in something, you know, I mean, what's in it for them? Just as, you know, if a union member doesn't have a stake in helping someone stopping foreclosures elsewhere in the city, they're okay in their house, then, you know, are they going to do something?
I think you're absolutely right, Jack, and I think the reason that I, based on many years of working with the Jobs with Justice Coalition in Boston, believe that the Jobs with Justice model is one that should be more heavily financed by the AFL is because it doesn't depend on inside the beltway top-level officials of the NAACP or La Raza or the Sierra Club or women's organizations coming together with their counterparts who are a decidedly mixed bag on the executive council of the AFL-CIO. At the local level, as you point out, it's more face-to-face kind of interaction that's possible between rank-and-file activists from labor and non-labor organizations. And the key, as you pointed out also, is unions getting beyond a kind of opportunistic transactional relationship with community partners. You know, it's very common for unions where they get into a bind and a difficult strike, a tough bargaining situation, an organizing campaign where workers have been fired, you know, to call out the community, to call ministers, to call students, to call this group and that group in labor's moment of need. But to have a real coalition, a real ongoing partnership to build power together, it has to be a two-way street. The solidarity has to be reciprocal, and unions, as you say, have to be there when a community organization in Boston is fighting eviction of people from their homes. The union has to be there for immigrant workers when they're, you know, faced with a deportation threat. They have to support students when they're fighting tuition increases at the state university. And, you know, what we find out in the experience of a network like Jobs with Justice is that, you know, union members aren't unidimensional. They have multiple identities. Some of them are gay and are involved in the movement for gay rights. Some of them are part-time students. Some of them are clearly immigrants. And some of them are, you know, involved in a wide range of non-labor organizations, you know, whose activities really are mutually supportive with the program of organized labor. So I think you're right. The place to build this is from the bottom up at the local level. And, you know, don't wait for these things to happen at the top because there's too many bureaucratic obstacles. And even when they get it together at the top, the trickle-down effect is, you know, it takes too long to have a real impact where it counts the most.
Yeah, what we see, you described very well. You know, I was in labor a number of years, too, and what you see is, as you point out, when labor is in a crisis, union labor, it calls on community groups to, you know, jump in and increase its weight in the struggle, whatever, and then when it's over, it disappears. And there's more community going into the labor than labor going into community today. That's a problem. I just don't see anything permanent happening without some organizational restructuring at the grassroots level here. Otherwise, what you get and what you described is kind of a labor version of Occupy. A spontaneous thing happens when there is an event, a crisis, and then it disappears. Right, and we see what happens with Occupy. Didn't believe in organization, and of course it dissipated pretty much. And you know, it's out there, but remnants doing this or that. Right? Well, that's, you know, this labor's version of Occupy, without structure, without organization. Okay, I want you to comment on that, and I still want both of you to flesh out a little bit more of the politics that might have led to this retreat on affiliation talk by Trumka before the convention, and you know now it's just this vague partnership stuff again, not really true affiliation. I want you both to comment what you think about that, Carl and Steve. But let's take one quick break here, and then we'll come right back with that question. This is Jack Rasmus, Alternative Visions. We'll be back in a moment.
Now sometimes tomorrow comes soaked in treasure and blood. Here we stood the job. Now we'll stand the flood. There's a new world coming.
Thank you.
This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. Alternative Visions, my guest, Steve Early and Carl Fenimore, who were both at the AFL-CIO convention, observing as press delegates here the events of the convention. And we're focusing on this this topic in the convention that seemed to have some promise before of the AFL-CIO bringing in community groups at a significant level, in which they'd have some of affiliation and some decision-making power and some, you know, perhaps some sort of alternate voting status on the strategy and directions of the AFL-CIO. But it seems to me that they got a lot of pushback from other unions, probably building trades and others, who said, no, we don't want that, we don't need that. Let's just keep going with this loose partnership relationship with community groups, Jobs for Justice, you know, and all these worker centers have done great work, but it's like an untapped, it's like an untapped resource that's not really integrated into the main strategy of the AFL-CIO. There's so much potential for worker centers and Jobs for Justice and so forth that the AFL-CIO just hasn't tapped, I believe, and formalized and structured. And it's got to do something, as Trump himself has indicated in my quote, we're at a point where we really must do something differently. We really have to experiment, quote unquote. The crisis for labor has deepened. Well, sure has, unquote.
Well, look, Jack,
so what's the new experiment coming out? Is there anything? Carl?
Well, Ariel Sullivan. Oh, go ahead, Steve. You had something to say.
No, I didn't mean to interrupt. I get frustrated sometimes, you know, with that kind of rhetoric because there's not always the official follow-through. I mean, Jobs with Justice, has got a track record of 25 years of effective community labor coalition building work. It receives a subsidy from the AFL-CIO of $100,000 a year. Now, that's chicken feed. That's the same the AFL was giving it in 1997, not even a cost of living increase. The budget, annual budget of the AFL-CIO is $140 million. Now, obviously, it has a lot of other expenses. But, you know, one test of whether there's a real commitment beyond resolution passing to helping build the strength of the labor movement through community alliances at the local level will be whether or not Jobs with Justice gets a spending increase from the AFL. I mean, part of the problem is, you know, the institutional concern about branding. I quite frankly think that sometimes the AFL is more interested in just putting its own brand on things and is a little concerned about the kind of autonomy and independence that Jobs with Justice coalitions have demonstrated on a number of occasions in many cities. So in some cities, they have a very good and cooperative working relationship with local AFL-CIO central labor bodies and state federations. But, you know, the proof of the pudding is whether the check's in the mail. And if the check to Jobs with Justice this year from Mitch Trumka is the same amount as last year, then I think there's a gap between his rhetoric and the reality of the institution's commitment to doing this kind of work.
And yeah, I would just add to that that, if there were a serious structure, organizational structure that integrated community groups and labor at the grassroots level, yes, there would have to be some funding. And the funding would have to benefit both community groups who are members and labor union groups that were members. It has to be a mutual relationship if you're going to get beyond this just ad hoc when there's a crisis, come out and help us, and maybe we'll come out and help you. That's no community labor alliance. Carl, what do you think of all that?
Well, I agree, and by the same token, you need a program to really mobilize the
youth.
Good
point, Carl.
Pardon me?
Good point. I had to inject. Sorry.
No, thank you. To attract the youth, you've got to have a program. You can't be fighting for $10 an hour. You can't, as the when the youth are demanding 15, working families are demanding 15. That way you might get 13. If you only argue for 10, you're not going to get 11. So single-payer health care. At the convention, they refused to say anything about Syria. Trumka, in a press conference with us, said, I don't know enough about it to take a position. Yeah, you know enough about it. You know that that your Democratic Party friends are about ready to send us to war, and you weren't willing to take a position on it. If you keep within the timid conservative confines politically of the Democratic Party, and you don't have an independent voice, you're going to be unable to mobilize the youth, people of color, that, you know, and it's going to fail. And that's why it's been top down. It's been top down for a number of reasons. As I say, local units of the unions have been depoliticized and demobilized for decades, and they've even recognized it. Larry Cohen, head of the Communication Workers of America with over 1 million members, said, you know, we're not going to get all our locals to do this. Some don't agree, some aren't capable. You had Terry O'Sullivan from the president of the laborers say, hey, we don't want these people coming in and having a voice on our council, the Sierra Club and others. They opposed the Keystone Pipeline, and we're for it. You had the firefighters, international firefighters, saying similar things. We don't want this to become the AFL, the American Federation of Labor and Progressive Organizations. So within the internally, even at the top level, this was from desperation of the most sophisticated elements, TRUMPCA, CWA, Unite Here, UFCW, who understood, hey, we're dying on the vine. We can't keep doing what we're doing. We got to reach out. We got to reach out to National Organization for Women. But if you don't, reaching out to the National Organization for Women, who the president spoke there, her president, Sandy, I forget her name, but she spoke. If you don't embrace, which the AFL-CIO has refused to do for decades, if you don't embrace reproductive rights for women, how are you going to really relate to it? You just can't relate to these youth and women and people of color on the one-dimensional level, programmatically, that the Democratic Party does, which is so afraid to even mention the word choice. So that's the problem I see, a number of problems. The formula is good, as Steve says. It's been something he and others have been arguing for 20 years. The Job for Justice Community Labor Coalition formula is good. But it will remain sterile and hollow if you politically do not adopt demands independently that are in the interest of the working class and the youth and the people of color. And in my opinion, until you do that, workers, those 150 million, will not join a union, no matter what you do organizationally. It's not been a question that there's been, we haven't tried this technique for organizing. We've tried everything. But as long as you have not raised and lift the standard of living of the ones you've got already organized, who are falling behind, you're not going to, why should others join a union?
But, Carl, what good are progressive demands if you don't have an organization to implement them?
Well,
is my question. It seems to me, yes, it's easy to come up with progressive demands, and the AFL-CIO has many of them. But if you don't have an organization that allows you and a strategy that includes we're going to take this and that and so forth action to implement these demands, then nothing's really going to happen.
I guess it's the chicken and the egg, though. What comes first?
Well, maybe they both come at the same time, huh?
If you inspire people around ideas, they will come around and form an organization, in my opinion.
No. They may say, hey, yeah, I really agree with those, but tell me how we're going to do it. I mean, that's the ABCs of union organizing, isn't it? You go in and you talk to people and get their hopes going, and yes, you can have better. You don't have to have what you've got. Others have better. Look over there. But then, you know, you got to say, well, what are we going to do? 1, 2, 3 to get there.
Well, it's right.
Both are important, it seems to me.
Other teachers, how they did it. It took 6 years. They were organizing 6 years before their strike with the community about the closures and charter schools and everything, classroom size, everything. And the nurses, they go right into the hospitals. I interviewed teachers. I've interviewed nurses. And I'm telling you, they're rank-and-file members. And the hotel workers in San Francisco, rank-and-file members, know intimately everything about the employer attacks on them. They know about health care, why it's so important. They know about pensions. They know about the racism in the society. I mean, they are educated on a range of issues. It really was totally sharp contrast to members in my own union.
But, Carl, even if you, let me play devil's advocate once more, even if you have a real conscious union membership, with union membership so low today and with bargaining under attack everywhere today, can you get out of the hole by yourself, union labor? Or does it have to take some new form of labor community organization, especially at the grassroots, to pull yourself out of this hole? It seems to me that the AFL-CIO and its major leaders know they're in trouble, want to do something about it, but will not take the organizational step, which means they fall back into, well, let's go hat in hand to the Democratic Party and maybe they'll throw us a few crumbs. Well, now they don't even throw you crumbs. You can't even get the Employee Free Choice Act out of committee. You can't even get positions on the NLRB. You get nothing. I don't see what the heck they're getting out of the relationship with the Democratic Party anymore, but yet they seem to be tying themselves deeper and deeper into it as the their crisis gets bigger and bigger. That's just my perspective. Steve, what do you think of that?
Well, I think there's a very pressing issue that you mentioned earlier in the show that is probably the best one for unions to try to organize, mobilize, and educate their existing members about, and that's the healthcare crisis, which is certainly not being alleviated by Obamacare. There's a huge backlash developing the grassroots of labor as a result of the way the Affordable Care Act is being implemented, which is having the effect of undermining negotiated union health coverage and driving down the better standards of medical care that union members have been able to win. That's a very, very serious problem, particularly since the ACA was backed by the bulk of the labor movement and sold to the rank and file as a way forward, as a way of making things better, of making negotiations easier, of covering everybody and solving a lot of the problems that both organized and unorganized workers had. Every negotiation that unions are involved in, and that is the main point of contact between the union as an organization and the members, the time when union members relate most to the organization, should be politicized around this issue. Both public sector and private sector employers who are constantly seeking medical care givebacks and health care cost shifting need to be challenged at the bargaining table to support national health insurance, Medicare for All, the single-payer system. Members during contract campaigns to resist these kinds of concessions need to be educated in a way that will be much more effective than abstract preaching about the virtues of single payer when they're in these kinds of fights. I mean, CWA, in my experience in New England over nearly 30 years of bargaining, always injected the issue of single payer and pushing the employers to partner with labor for a change in the system that would take benefits off the bargaining table. It was an essential part of our contract campaign strategy. And I think that's needed now more than ever before, particularly in the public sector when employers at every level of government are coming after the medical plans of public employees that are often better than those of the taxpayers in the community they serve. And if they don't position themselves as supporters and defenders of a publicly funded system of universal health care coverage, their coverage is going to be torn down, and nobody else is going to benefit from that. But this is a tremendous opening, and the failure of Obamacare is really one that if the unions do the grassroots education and mobilization work that's necessary, could greatly strengthen and politicize their bargaining programs in a way that would be a big boost to the still much needed single payer movement.
Yeah, and if you know, Obamacare ACA destroys union negotiated health care plans, and there are, you know, destruction going on, the last vestiges of it for defined benefit pension plans. What about this main labor strategy of maintenance of benefits? I mean, it's defunct. It's gone. and then what the hell do you do? Well, look, you know, on this ACA, you make a good point. There is a big crisis for labor here on with the ACA, and it's going to get worse, I predict. But, you know, this is a good example of where alliances, you know, integrated alliances, have a great possibility here. I mean, let's not forget the tax on Medicare and Medicaid. We got the debt ceiling coming up. Obama's already agreed $630 billion cuts in Social Security and Medicare. That's just the beginning. Why isn't labor forming nationwide Social Security defense clubs? Right? I mean, that's how Social Security started, defense clubs. And by the way, you know, even the Democrats, when it first started in the 1930s, were opposed to Social Security. It was the grassroots organizing and rebellion between workers and other folks, seniors and so forth, in the 1930s that really produced Social Security. But I don't see anything happening along those lines led by organized labor.
Well, you know, yes. There's a perverse part of that you're pointing out, which is because of the conservative leadership of the unions, particularly since the 1950s, early 50s, when unions gave up what you're talking about, national health care, national pension reform, expand Social Security for everybody earlier and with a living wage. They gave up all that and instead just fought for pensions and health care for their own workers. Now, that today, why they're so, particularly the building trades, are so afraid of having their multi-employer plans be taxed out of existence by Obamacare after 2014 is because that's the biggest selling point they have for their members. Hey, yeah. We'll get you a pension. We'll get you health care. Minus that, which is the reason they don't fight, in my view, for the rights of all working people to have these same benefits, because that's what makes them distinct. Absent that, they're going to have to produce other things, like taking on the employer on safety and health, wages, on the job. And that they're deathly afraid of doing. I mean, strikes are at an all-time low. It's true that it's very difficult to strike. There's legislation that has handcuffed it. This most democratic capitalist country in the world has the worst trade union laws in the English-speaking industrial world.
The anti-labor legislation does not restrict non-union members from striking and picketing and doing all the other stuff that occurs in strikes, does it?
No, but that's why the work centers
and just ask the community groups to do this for you without some real structure and a real stake in the game for everybody. That's my point.
Yes, I agree. But it could be challenged anyway, these laws. They have to be challenged by organized labor. Totally undemocratic and really unconstitutional, I believe, the right of assembly and everything else. They just totally, mass picketing, for example, they just totally make it impossible to have an effective strike without jeopardizing the union's treasury, threatening to sue.
Steve, I know in Richmond you're heavily involved with this eminent domain, let's stop the foreclosures movement in Richmond, the city in California, where you hail from. What lesson is there for labor union community alliances? And what's going on? Is there really alliance there, or is it the community fighting on its own?
No, I think certainly the progressive leadership and municipal government here in Richmond has some labor support. The city workers, for example, who are represented by service employees, Local 1021, have been very supportive of Mayor Gail McLaughlin, who's a Green Party member, and other members of the city council who are supported by the Richmond Progressive Alliance, as Gail is. And so there is a community labor component to many of the innovative policy initiatives that have been undertaken by Mayor McLaughlin, the most recent one being this threatened use of the city's eminent domain powers to try to slow the rate of home foreclosures and force banks to renegotiate home mortgage loan terms with underwater homeowners. This has generated a lot of publicity, much political controversy, a huge counterattack by the banksters who have sued to block this initiative. And the outcome is still in doubt. But I think it shows that when a community concern that also affects union members who are among those whose homes are at risk in Richmond, when these two forces come together, they can do some pretty creative and amazing things, go on the offensive and challenge corporate power at the local level in a way that's sometimes hard to do in the national legislative arena.
Do we have any local unions in the area whose members are in Richmond who have taken a formal position in support of that eminent domain?
Well, I think that's less important than the fact that they contribute in an ongoing way to building the Richmond Progressive Alliance as the electoral and community organizing vehicle that has made Mayor McLaughlin a two-term mayor and created enough of a kind of left liberal narrow majority on the city council to take these kind of innovative anti-foreclosure measures. And
Okay, I want to thank you. We're beginning to run out of time here. I hear the music coming. I just want to say something in conclusion here, a bit of reiterating of what I've already said. And I think the AFL-CIO realizes this is nearing the end game. By the end of the decade, there will be only 3% unionized in the private sector if they don't really do something. But I don't think they can make that break towards the community and real allies, and can't make the break from the Democratic Party, who are false allies, who haven't delivered a damn thing in a decade, from what I can see, for union labor. I think that something has to happen in terms of a major shift here, in terms of labor community structure at the grassroots, beginning there. And, you know, it's got to be something where both sides are equal in the game, equal skin in the game, and it has to be an ongoing structure. Once again, if there was any lesson from Occupy, it is that you just can't have these ad hoc struggles come and go, and have any real sustained progress. There has to be a structure where the best activists from union labor and the best activists from the community get together and fight together on mutual interests. And it's, as you said, Steve, it's got to be funded. Somebody's got to put money into this thing, because if you want that kind of structure, you have to have full-time organizers, community labor organizers. And, you know, they don't have to be in conflict with the labor councils. They can be in addition to the labor councils. And this has to happen if there's going to be some real revitalization of the labor movement, I believe. And I'm going to be writing on this for my listeners, a piece called Reinventing Union Labor in America. Okay, I want to thank both of you for this very informative discussion, and I hope our listeners call in and let us know if they like this kind of discussion, because this is not a matter that is finished. We're going to be seeing this continually here going forward. So I'd like to thank you, Steve, and Carl, for giving us your insights on the crisis of American labor, and not just the AFL-CIO convention, which I'm sure there were a lot of other things we could have talked about in the convention. Maybe we will down the road. But in the meantime, thanks for coming on. And
thanks for having us.
Listen to you all next week. Alternative Vision.